Star Walker Studios presents Game Master's Journey, your multidimensional RPG podcast. Hello, fellow gamer. Welcome to episode 133 of Game Master's Journey, your multidimensional RPG podcast. I'm Lex Starwalker, and on this show, we discuss the craft and art of game mastering. Not only do I pass along any knowledge I've gained over 25 plus years of running RPGs, I also share wisdom from guest GMs and listener GMs like you. Today, I'll discuss bringing strongholds and followers back from 1st edition into 5th edition for use in my Primordia games, but before that, I'll review some of the 5th edition supplements being put out by Limitless Adventures. So join me on the journey. Together, we can become game masters truly worthy of the title. Well, it is good to be back here talking to you today about RPGs and gaming and game mastering and all that good stuff. Really love doing this show, and it's always great to be back behind the mic and getting into the nerdiness and awesomeness of this hobby. I've been getting a lot of great feedback on recent episodes, and I really appreciate everyone who's given me feedback. Thank you so much. Really appreciate it. And our community over on Google Plus for Game Master's Journey has been going strong. We've gotten a lot of new members in the last week, and hearing from some new members, we just had a member post their homebrew world this week, which is super cool. And we've got other people that post on a regular basis and really like what's going on over there at the Game Master's Journey community. Great time. I spent a good chunk of my day Sunday just interacting with people on the community. We had some really interesting threads about various things going on, and people have really great ideas over there. And, you know, this probably isn't news to anyone who actually pays attention to the community, but a lot of times topics for this show come directly out of discussions on the community. Sometimes I'll be planning to discuss something on the show, so I'll bring it up to the community to kind of get some ideas from other people before I broach the subject on the show. And then other times, me or someone else on the community starts a conversation and it gets going, and I think, hey, this is a good idea of something to talk about on the show. So it's a very symbiotic relationship, and it works quite well. So actually, one of our topics today, namely bringing strongholds and followers back into the game, is a topic that I broached with the community this last weekend, just to kind of share some of this with people in the community and get some thoughts from people. So I'm going to be covering some of that today later on in the episode, and talking about kind of how strongholds and followers worked in first edition as a beginning to coming up with something for 5th edition that's going to work for me in my homebrew world of Primordia. So if you played 1st edition and you remember the strongholds and followers rules from back in those days, this might be nostalgic for you. It might be kind of nice to revisit those simpler times. And for those of you who didn't play 1st edition, you might be interested to hear how this all worked back then, when this was very much a fundamental part of the game and was very much a part of your character's advancement and your character's evolution on that path from farmer to cosmic hero that we so often see in D&D. And, you know, it's unfortunate that we've lost that in 5th edition. And I think that its absence is very much felt. And there is kind of this hole in the game where something's missing. And that something that's missing is strongholds and followers. But we'll talk more about that later in the episode. So one thing I like doing at the top of the show is sharing with you some polls that I put up on the Game Master's Journey community, and looking for some ideas for new polls. So if you have an idea of a good question for one of these polls, please let me know, because this is the last one that I've done in the past. So now I got to come up with something new. So this poll I asked way back in September, just now getting around to talking about it. And the question was very simple. What's your favorite published campaign for 5th edition so far? And the choices, the campaigns we've had for this game so far are Tyranny of Dragons, Princes of the Apocalypse, Out of the Abyss, Curse of Strahd, and Storm King's Thunder. Now, I got to say, I think that Storm King's Thunder maybe got shafted a little bit because when I put this poll up, that game or that campaign was still very new, still is new enough that I doubt anyone's finished it who did the whole thing. But this has been up since September, so people have had plenty of time to vote on it if they've since got more exposure to Storm King's Thunder and thought it was worthy of a vote. So I got to say, the winner of this is not at all surprising to me. So we got 31 votes for this poll, and of those, 55% voted Curse of Strahd as the best campaign put out by Wizards for 5th edition so far. And I mean, that was hands over fist the winner. Our next most popular was a three-way tie at 13% each between Princes of the Apocalypse, Out of the Abyss, and Storm King's Thunder. And then Tyranny of Dragons came in last at 6%. So we had Curse of Strahd, 55% said that was their favorite. 13% of people said either Princes of the Apocalypse, Out of the Abyss, or Storm King's Thunder were their favorite. So 13% each, or a total of 39%. For those three, and then 6% said Tyranny of Dragons. So I ran a good chunk of Tyranny of Dragons. I played some of Princes of the Apocalypse and have since read Princes of the Apocalypse. I read Out of the Abyss. I ran a good chunk of Curse of Strahd, and I ran a little bit of Storm King's Thunder. But I've read all of these, and I have to say that my vote would go with Curse of Strahd too. It is just a phenomenal campaign. And, you know, to the point that if someone asks me, hey, Lex, I want to play 5th edition and I want to start out with a published campaign, which one would I get? My first follow-up question to that would be, how do you feel about horror and Ravenloft? And if the person is at all cool with horror and Ravenloft, I'd say Curse of Strahd. Hands down, the best that they put out so far. And I think the only reason that I would recommend something other than Curse of Strahd to someone would be if they weren't really into horror, or they weren't really into Ravenloft, or they're kind of like me where it's like, yeah, I can take some horror in small doses, but I don't know if I want to play a long-term campaign that's nothing but gothic horror. That might get a little old. So someone like that, I might suggest one of the other ones to them, but barring any of those kind of deal breakers, I would say Curse of Strahd. It's a great campaign. It's a nice blend of linear and sandbox, and has a great antagonist that the NPCs ideally, or I'm sorry, the PCs ideally will encounter again and again through the adventure. And the adventure itself gives great advice on how to create a nemesis like that and how to properly role play and use a nemesis like that, not just in the final showdown, but throughout the entire campaign. So even for someone who maybe doesn't want to run Curse of Strahd, but wants to learn how to better use an antagonist like that, I would even recommend it for that GM as well. But if you want to know more about Curse of Strahd, and if you want to know more specifically about my thoughts on Curse of Strahd, I did a full review of Curse of Strahd on episode 111, and I will have a link to that episode in the show notes for this episode over at starwalkerstudios.com/gamemastersjourney. All right, so there's the results of that poll. Curse of Strahd, clear winner there, and looking for more ideas for polls. So if you have an idea for a good poll question, shoot me an email, gamemastersjourney@gmail.com, and let me know, and I'll put a poll up for everyone to vote on.
This is Shane from the Total Party Thrill Podcast, and you're listening to Lex Starwalker on Game Master's Journey.
I want to give a quick shout out to the patrons of Starwalker Studios. The support of the patrons makes this show possible. If you enjoy Game Master's Journey and you'd like to give a little back, becoming a patron is a great way to do so. Patrons get some cool perks like game material I make for Primordia and access to a special monthly podcast I produce just for the patrons. I'd also like to give a huge shout out and thank you to my tier 4 patron, Mr. Steve Strickland. Let's hear it for Steve.
Yeah.
Yes.
You the man.
You the man.
Thank you so much, Steve, and thank you to all the patrons. You can find out more about becoming a patron by clicking on the Patreon button at the top of the show notes at starwalkerstudios.com. All right, for our first segment today, I thought I would share with you a little bit about Limitless Adventures and some of the products that they've been putting out for 5th edition D&D. And these guys were kind enough to send me some review copies of some of their stuff, and I've been checking it out, and I thought I would talk to you about it today. So I'll have a link to their website over at the show notes for this episode at starwalkerstudios.com. And you can go check out all the stuff they have. Pretty much they're putting out 3 products pretty much every month. And these are relatively small little products that you can get. They have a few different types. They have encounters. And so they have different ones. They've got epic encounters, forest encounters, coast encounters, and things like that. And they vary in price, usually $2 to $3. And they will have just a few encounters in there for you. Some of these products are monsters or NPCs or various things. So again, they range in price from about $2 to about $3. So they're pretty cheap, small little supplements that you can use for your game, and they're pretty targeted so you can find the thing that you want. For instance, what I have here, let's see here, I've got a few of them here that I printed out. So for instance, they have one, Dungeon Encounters, and this has 10 random encounters for a dungeon setting for levels 1 to 4. So for this, you know, let's say you're doing a dungeon adventure and you want some more ideas for some more encounters, you can grab this. This has 10 encounters in it, and you can use some of them in your adventure. Another one that I have here is the Monster Pack 1, which is just some more monsters for the game. And this has 10 monsters. And just looking at their site, another one that they have is Curse of the Ice Mage. So this is a short adventure for 5-6 level characters. They also have some stuff that tie into some of Wizards in the Coast things. So for instance, they have Storm King's Thunder Encounters, which are 10 encounters that you can add into the Storm King's Thunder campaign if you're using that. So why don't I go through some of the ones that I've looked at and tell you about them. So first of all, I have the Monster Pack 1. And again, this is 10, you know, new monsters. The monsters we have in here are the Skeletal Guardian, which is a more powerful skeleton. It's a CR1 skeleton. Storm Elemental, Skeletal Blue Dragon, Duende, which is a simian creature. It's a fey creature. Half Red Dragon Wyvern, Apprentice Mage, Charnel Hound, Fighter Mage, Pestilence Harpy, Abyssal Warlock, and Animated Object, Animated Ballista. So those are the monsters in this particular little pack. And this is $1.99 on the site for this PDF. Now, one thing that's cool about this is, you know, not only do you get a monster and you get a stat block, you also get a short description, which is something that the Monster Manual lacks and is really lacking. Those would be nice to have. So for instance, Skeletal Guardian here, we have a skeletal warrior clad in scraps of armor in a grimy tabard. So each of these has a short little description like that you could read aloud to the players or paraphrase if you wanted. We then have the stat block. And we have some, you know, description, just like what you would have in the Monster Manual. Some of these have a designer note, which I quite enjoy, which is just, you know, something from the designer about what they were thinking when they made this monster or something like that. So for instance, for the Skeletal Guardian, it says, "I've always thought that skeletons were interesting and visually unsettling monsters, but they are too weak to pose much of a threat after level one. The Skeletal Guardian is simply a tougher skeleton. They pose a more serious threat at lower levels and work well as minions at higher levels." So again, not all of these will have a designer note, but it's really cool when they do. Another thing that's included with the monster entries that I really like is they have a section on treasure. So they will tell you if this monster will have treasure, and if so, what that treasure might be. And again, this is something lacking in the monster manual. You basically have to decide for yourself as a DM if you think a particular monster would have treasure, and then if they do, go to the DMG and use the appropriate treasure table based on their CR. So this is nice because it's more individualized for that particular monster. So for instance, with the Skeletal Guardian here, it says Skeletal Guardians no longer care for treasure, though their weapons are usually well-maintained and serviceable. So, you know, this is telling you you're not going to find golden gems from one of these skeletons, but you could use their weapon if they have a weapon, you know, like maybe you have a short sword and the Skeletal Guardian has a long sword. You could use that long sword. But some of the monsters that do have actual treasure, they will give some guidance like, oh, you know, this treasure might be in the form of coins or gems or whatever. So it's always nice to have information like that as a GM that you can either use or ignore. And then the other thing I really like about their monster entries and also their encounters have these same features. They have the treasure and the description and all that. The other thing I really like is they have a further adventure section. And what this is they give three little plot hooks that you can use to do more with this monster or this encounter than what you have right in front of you. And the encounters that they have the same thing. So for instance, with the Skeletal Guardian, you know, one of these is the PCs could require an item located in a tomb where skeletal guardians dressed in the trappings of a goodly god guard the entrance. So, you know, each of these will give you three ways that you can use the monster or additional things you could do after the encounter, things like that, which are really great to have. So that's the Monster Pack 1, and they have a few of these monster packs now. Also, I've got Dungeon Encounters, which I mentioned before, which are 10 encounters. And these are all using monsters from the Monster Manual. So these aren't new monsters. Rather, they're taking monsters from the Monster Manual and building encounters around them. Some of the encounters are just with one monster or one type of monster. Some of them are a group of different monsters working together. So this will give you, you know, the monsters that are involved in the encounter, kind of a setup for the encounter. And then again, they give recommended treasure and also, you know, three adventure hooks of places you could go after this encounter. You're also often given some background for the encounter and personality or motive information for the NPC or monster in the encounter, and that can be really helpful too. So these are really cool. And like anything I review on the show, you know, whether this is something that you would want or not really depends on you as a GM and what you're looking for. You know, so like these dungeon encounters, there's no new monsters in here. These are just monsters from the Monster Manual, and they're just making some encounters for you with them. And, you know, for some DMs, that's going to be exactly what the doctor ordered, and they're going to love that and be all over that. And there might be other DMs that are like, why would I even want that? I can come up with my own encounters using monsters from the Monster Manual. I don't need this. So, you know, not every product is going to appeal to everyone. So each of these definitely has a certain kind of DM that the product is kind of for. Like this dungeon encounters, I would say these are very useful for a less experienced DM, or maybe a DM that just doesn't have any time to come up with stuff. Maybe you don't want to run a canned adventure, but at the same time, you don't have a lot of time to figure out encounters and whatnot. So you can get something like this dungeon encounters, and it'll help you out. Also, it's $1.99. So, you know, not a huge investment to get this and maybe, you know, use some of this. And I feel like me personally, if I bought this for $2, you know, 10 encounters, if I used, you know, one or two of those and it went well in my game, I'd feel like I got my $2 worth. you know, even if I only used one or two out of the 10 encounters. So another one I have here is Haunted Locales, which is another set of encounters. So the last one was Dungeon Encounters, encounters to use in a dungeon. This is 10 encounters that you can use in a cemetery, a crypt, or some other similar kind of haunted horror type location. So this one, again, you know, each of these encounters has the monsters involved, the treasure, has three adventure hooks you can use. And this one actually also has a spell in it, which is pretty sweet. And one of the encounters in this one in Haunted Locales involves a lich. So this is kind of nice to see how, you know, one DM at least might use a lich and might set up an encounter using a lich. So pretty cool stuff. And then another one I have here is Curse of the Ice Mage. This one I mentioned before, I think this is a short little adventure. So this is basically just one quest, probably, you know, this could be a one-shot adventure. Comes with a little map, little, you know, four-room little building to explore. And, you know, just very, you know, you could do this in one session pretty easy. You know, it's not like a full-blown adventure or a campaign or anything like that. It's just a short little adventure quest with a few encounters that go together. And, you know, that could be something that you just want to do a one shot and you use it for that. Or it could be something where you have a larger story going in your campaign and you just want to have a quick interlude or have a side plot or something like that. And, you know, I discussed a little bit the joys of having subplots and side quests in episode 132. So this is something that you could use for that. So these are pretty cool. And what I like about them is that they're very focused and they're cheap. You know, you don't have to shell out $20 to buy something that, you know, maybe you'll never use or maybe it won't be any good. I mean, you don't know, right, until you get it and look at it. So this is nice because you can get one of these things for $2 or $3 and you can get exactly what you want. You know, if you're looking for encounters for in a forest, they have one for that. If you're looking for encounters on a coast, they have one for that. So you can get kind of exactly what you're looking for without having to buy a bunch of stuff that you don't want, right? Like they could easily put out a book of 100 encounters and you have to buy the whole thing. And maybe you just want the desert encounters. So that's kind of cool. You can kind of grab these things a la carte. None of them are individually very expensive. And, you know, if you get one or two of these and you really like them, then you can be pretty confident that you're going to like all the stuff Limitless Adventures does and you can get more of them. However, if a la carte isn't your jam and you'd rather just like get all this stuff all at once, you can do that too. Limitless Adventures right now is running a Kickstarter for Limitless Encounters Volume 1 for 150 5th edition encounters. And this, they've basically taken all these encounters, I believe 15 of them, and they're compiling them into one book, and they're doing a Kickstarter for it. So as of recording, they've got 10 days left to go on the Kickstarter. They're already well beyond their goal. Their goal was $5,000. They're getting close to $9,000. So this is definitely going to fund. So, you know, if Kickstarter isn't your thing, you know, this is something that's going to happen now. So you can just wait. And I'm sure once the Kickstarter is over and the Kickstarter has been fulfilled, I'm sure this book will be available on Limitless Adventures website and you can just buy it there and you don't have to deal with Kickstarter at all. Or if you're in the Kickstarter, you can go check out their Kickstarter and I'll have that linked in the show notes at starwalkerstudios.com as well. And you can get in on the Kickstarter. So let's see here. It looks like at the $20 level, you get the full color PDF of Limitless Encounters Volume 1. So $20 for the PDF of this whole thing. For $25, you can get the black and white soft cover copy, which will be 175 pages. Or for $30, you can get the full color soft cover version. So $20 for the PDF, $25 for the black and white, or $30 for the full color. Personally, I think that's a little steep for a PDF. If I can get the print version for $5 more, I think a $20 price point for that PDF might be a little high, or the price points for the print versions are too low. One of the two. but you know, your mileage may vary. So definitely check this out. Check out their stuff. If you're doing fifth edition, you might find these really helpful. And you know, I've looked at quite a bit of third party stuff throughout my years of running and playing RPGs, and I've seen really good third party stuff, and I've seen really bad third party stuff. And even just fifth edition, I've seen a pretty wide spectrum of, you know, terrible to good third-party stuff. So you know, looking through this, it's well-written, well-edited. I'm not seeing typos or grammatical errors jumping out at me. In fact, I've seen fewer errors like that in these than I saw in Volo's Guide, which had quite a few typos sneak past the editors for some reason. So no problems like that. They're well written, you know, easy to understand. They give you the information you need without wasting your time with a bunch of words you don't need. The descriptions are good and to the point and evocative, you know, the kind of descriptions you want to give as a GM. Again, they're giving you just enough. They're not like giving you way more than you need or want. They're giving you enough to get you going and that you can build on if you want to. And another thing, I don't know about the book that they're going to put out from the Kickstarter, but you know, these little PDFs that you get a la carte are pretty light on art, which I actually like. It makes them very nice for printing. You know, if I get a PDF and I'm actually going to use it in my game, then I'm going to print it. And it's nice that I'm not going to use up all my expensive color ink or a lot of ink to print these. And, you know, that's really nice. And, you know, I think some third-party products, you know, they go a little crazy with the art and the colors and stuff, and it just makes it more expensive for you to print the stuff out. And unless the art is really amazing and you're going to actually show it to your player characters, like, you don't really, as a DM, need art to print out for your notes to use during the game for like one of these encounters. So it's nice to either not have art or have the art be black and white line art that isn't going to eat up a lot of ink, or have it be on its own page so you don't have to print it out if you don't want to, and you can just show an image of it on your tablet or whatever to the PCs. So I really appreciate that. I haven't actually play tested any of the monsters or encounters, but just looking over them, I don't see anything jumping out at me as not fitting the rest of the monsters in the game or doing anything strange mechanically that we haven't seen other monsters do. Everything, at least just looking at it, looks balanced and like it fits the system. And if you're wondering, well, can you really tell by looking at it? Sometimes you can. You know, for instance, I did a review of Tome of Beasts recently by Kobold Press. And, you know, of course, since I've done the review, I've had even more time to pore over Tome of Beasts. And there are numerous creatures in Tome of Beasts that I kind of wonder about and seem like they might be broken or overpowered or just don't fit the other creatures in the game, or seem more like, you know, maybe you took a Pathfinder creature and just converted it to fifth edition without really making it really fit fifth edition. So for instance, you'll have creatures that for some reason get a +2 bonus, which we don't really see in fifth edition, or get a +5 bonus or whatever, instead of giving him advantage. You'll see creatures that their special thing is they can have more than one bonus action, which to my knowledge, I haven't seen anything else in this system do that before. So you have to kind of wonder, you know, is this creature having multiple bonus actions? Is that really balanced or not? Again, I don't know. I'd have to play test it to be sure. But, you know, you can see things like that kind of are like, this doesn't seem quite right. And I didn't spot anything like that in the Limitless Adventures stuff that I've looked over. It looks like, unlike some other third-party stuff I've seen, this was actually developed for 5th edition and wasn't made for something like 13th Age or 3rd edition or Pathfinder and then just, quote, converted to 5th edition. I mean, there are conversions and then there are conversions, right? And to me, a good conversion really fits the system and isn't using mechanics like giving someone a +2 or a +5 that you see a lot in the other system like Pathfinder, but you don't really see in fifth edition. Again, without playtesting, I'm as confident as I can be that the stuff by Limitless Adventures is going to work. It's not going to break your game. It's not going to be underpowered or overpowered compared to stuff in the Monster Manual. And finally, back to these encounters that are just using monsters from the Monster Manual and using them in encounters and kind of setting up an encounter for you. You know, this kind of thing can really be helpful for new GMs or inexperienced GMs because it's the whole learning by doing thing and learning by example. And it's much more helpful, I think, for a new GM to see something like this where here's an encounter that we made with these creatures. And, you know, here's the setup for this encounter. Here's how it's going to work. And here's, you know, some different ways you could go with it. I think that's a lot more helpful to a new GM than just like a theoretical discussion on how to build a balanced encounter. It's a lot more helpful to see an example of that being done. And so you can see a lot of examples in these products. So I think for new GMs, they're going to be very useful. I think for GMs that are really strapped for time, they're going to be very useful. But if you're a kind of do-it-yourself kind of GM and you have the time and the know-how and the gumption to come up with your own encounters and your own monsters and stuff, then, you know, this might not be terribly useful to you. It might seem kind of like, oh, I could do this myself. I mean, that's kind of how I felt about a lot of this stuff. I was like, oh, I could have come up with this, you know, but I'm probably not the target audience, right? This is more for newer GMs or less experienced GMs or GMs that just don't have the time. So if that's you, definitely check this out. So again, I'll have a link to Limitless Adventures website at starwalkerstudios.com. And there you can try these products out one by one, you know, a la carte. They're $2 to $3 a piece. Or if you want to get all the encounters all together, you can check out their Kickstarter or wait till that book is available. And I'll have a link to that in the show notes as well at starwalkerstudios.com. My favorite part of the show is when I hear from listener GMs like you. If you have feedback for the show, whether it's a comment on today's topic or an idea for a future topic, I'd love to hear from you. There are a lot of great ways to get a hold of me. You can email me at gamemastersjourney@gmail.com, follow me on Twitter at Lex Starwalker, Google+ Lex Starwalker, and finally, you can visit the website starwalkerstudios.com to get links to my Patreon page, YouTube channel, and more. I think that anyone who's listened to this show for very long at all probably knows that I'm a pretty big fan of 5th edition Dungeons & Dragons, and I've been playing D&D since the first edition days, and with the exception of original D&D and 4th edition, I've played every version of this game, including Pathfinder, and I really like 5th edition. It brings in a lot of the things that I liked from 1st and 2nd edition and kind of blends it in with a lot of the things I liked from 3rd edition and makes a great game, I think. But that said, you know, there are some really cool things from the history of the game that have been lost. And if you would have asked me a year ago or 2 years ago, I probably would have said that I think that eventually these things will come back in the form of supplements that Wizards will do in the future. Now that seems less likely. You know, in all this time, we've gotten the Sword Coast Adventurer's Guide and Volo's Guide to Monsters are the only non-adventure supplements we've gotten for 5th edition since the core three books. So it doesn't seem super likely that we're going to see, you know, systems returning from previous editions, which is fine. It gives me something to do. Right. So something that is missing from previous editions that I really miss in 5th edition is the whole having strongholds and followers and player characters having strongholds and followers. Back in 1st edition, this was like the thing, man. This was how, you know, you kind of made it as an adventurer and you were someone to be reckoned with, and you started to become, you know, more of a political force in the world, was when you were able to build your stronghold and start attracting followers. And it was a whole nother facet to the game, almost like its own little mini game. And, you know, some people loved it. Some people hated it. Some people were ambivalent. Some GMs used it. Some GMs didn't use it. Mileage varied, of course. But I like the idea. And I think that the idea fits very well in Primordia and will work especially well in Primordia. So I've been wanting to develop a system for strongholds and followers myself to use in my games, to use in Primordia. And, you know, I've been kicking around ideas about this for a while, but recently I started getting into the nitty gritty of the mechanics and starting to figure out, you know, exactly how I'm going to make this work. And so I thought that a good place to start would be at the source. So I got out the trusty old Dungeon Master's Guide from Advanced Dungeons and Dragons first edition and started reading up on the systems for strongholds and followers from back in the day. Figure I'll start there, use that as a launch point, and then go from there. So as I started, you know, looking through the section on NPCs as hirelings and followers and things like that, I quickly remembered or re-realized how much system and mechanics and granularity there was to all of that in first edition. Now, I'm not really surprised because, I mean, we are talking Advanced Dungeons and Dragons first edition here. So mechanics and granularity was kind of the word of the day back then. But I'd forgotten how much there actually was to it, you know, and it's funny because when I started thinking about doing this, I thought it was going to be a big job and the job was going to be, you know, coming up with mechanics to represent all this stuff and figuring all this out. And now I realize that it's still probably going to be a big job, but the job isn't so much with coming up with mechanics. I mean, there are plenty of examples of mechanics to start from. It's going to be figuring out a way to get this to do what I want it to do without getting into the territory of first edition where it gets too complicated and too unwieldy. So finding that sweet spot, that's going to be the tricky part. So I thought today for our world building segment, I'd talk a little bit about just kind of general concepts of how all this worked in first edition and maybe give some thoughts on how this would apply in Primordia in fifth edition. So you start out and we start out with a discussion about hirelings. And basically a hireling is just an NPC that a player character hires to do a job. And, you know, we see a little of this in fifth edition in the player's handbook. You know, we have a little section on NPC services and, you know, what it might cost to hire an NPC to carry stuff for you or whatever. But it's pretty limited compared to what we have in the Dungeon Master's Guide from first edition. So hirelings that might work for your character might include things like a tailor who makes your clothes, an armor smith who forges armor for you and repairs your armor, porters to carry stuff for you, servants to help keep your stronghold clean, and all kinds of stuff like that. Now, these NPCs are hirelings, which, as the name implies, you have to pay them. You have to pay these non-player characters a wage. And, you know, at least in first edition, this was a daily wage. You know, you'd have to pay them so much a day. And that wage depends on the service they provide. So it's not just a thing of a hireling costs a silver a day. It depends on what the hireling is and what they do. And the DMG had a pretty sizable chart with a pretty wide variety of hirelings you could hire and what they all cost. There's also a distinction made between three different types of hirelings. You started out, you had your common hirelings. So this could be someone like a porter or a messenger or a minstrel. These are people doing jobs that basically anybody can do. It's not a job requiring training or skill or anything like that. And so these guys are relatively cheap to hire. Next, we had the expert hirelings, and these were people like your alchemist or your engineer or your sage. So these are professions that require more knowledge and more training and more expertise. And because of that, expert hirelings cost a lot more to keep on staff than common hirelings. And they also can be more difficult to find. And first edition actually had a system tied into the size of a settlement, you know. So, you know, a common hireling you could find in a village, but to find an expert hireling, you had to go to a bigger town or city or whatever. And I don't remember off the top of my head what that system was, but it just correlated. You know, the more skilled a hireling was, the larger city you had to go to find someone like that. So, you know, if you're looking for a skilled scholar, you're going to have to go to a city. You're not going to find one in a village, most likely. Also, expert hirelings would often require equipment that the player character would have to supply. So, for example, if you wanted to hire an alchemist who's going to brew potions for you and stuff like that, then that alchemist would require a full laboratory that she could use. And, you know, you would have to pay for that yourself and have that in place and have a place for her to work before you could have any prayer of attracting an alchemist to work for you. So you had to set up the laboratory first and then try to find an alchemist. So we had common hirelings and expert hirelings. And then the third type of hireling was the mercenary soldier. And these are people that will actually fight for you, whether it's coming on an adventure with you or helping you defend your stronghold when you're gone, things like that. So dealing with these hirelings could be a pretty big money sink for characters in first edition, especially if you had very many hirelings, because all of these people, you got to pay so much silver or gold every day or every week, however you handle the accounting, which is a perpetual and constant drain on your money. Now, another big money sink that existed in first edition was building a stronghold. A lot of times you would actually build the stronghold as opposed to taking over one that already exists. And that was a lot of money. Or even if you take over a stronghold, chances are you had to besiege it and maybe did some damage to it, or it's been abandoned for a long time. Either way, there's going to be the cost of repairing it and getting it back up to code, so to speak. And then there were maintenance costs and just maintaining a stronghold. You know, your stronghold needs a staff, you know, hirelings that clean it and do all the things that need to be done in the stronghold. And you've got to pay them and you've got to feed them and clothe them and all that good stuff. So, you know, your hirelings and your strongholds in first edition were pretty big money sinks for PCs that really kind of bought in and went all in on that kind of stuff. And not only could be a money sink for individual PCs, but could be a money sink for the entire group, especially if you have a group where multiple PCs or maybe all the PCs have hirelings and strongholds. Then they're all needing that money and they're all needing to adventure more and grow their fortunes so that they can afford to pay all their hirelings and keep their stronghold up and running and still enjoy their opulent lifestyle that they've gotten used to as adventurers. So once you had a hireling and you've got this hireling working for you, your hireling could eventually become a henchman. So a henchman is a hireling that you've built a strong relationship with. And this was completely role-playing. You know, the advice given to the Dungeon Master in the Dungeon Master's Guide pretty much said that, you know, there isn't like a system to this. It's not like a player character makes an ability check and now they have a henchman. They have to role play it and they have to, you know, role play cultivating that relationship over time. They're not going to do it in a single gaming session. But if you've got a hireling and you really build this relationship, this friendship with that particular NPC, then that NPC can become a henchman. Now, a lot of this goes into the kind of the levels of these things. So in first edition, NPCs had levels just like player characters do. They had their own classes. They had NPC classes that were different from PC classes. It was very complicated. And I'm really glad that fifth edition has gotten away from that. But because of that, you know, you had to worry about the levels of NPCs. So your hirelings usually were first level and for the most part remained first level. You might have one get as high as maybe third or even fifth level, but that was pretty rare. But once a hireling became a henchman, now they can gain XP. They usually would get a PC class at this point. So instead of being an NPC warrior, they're now a PC fighter, which is just a better class. The NPC classes weren't as good as a PC class. So a first level fighter had more class abilities and perks than a first level warrior did, for instance. So your henchman gets a level in a PC class and now gains experience. So hirelings, you could have as many hirelings as you could afford to have. However, henchmen, you were limited to a certain number, and that number was determined by your charisma score. Your henchmen, like I said, could earn experience and gain levels. However, their maximum level was limited to 3/4 your PC's level. So if your player character is 20th level, your henchmen could get up to 15th level, but no higher. Henchmen got a half share of loot and experience that the PCs get from adventuring. And this got a little mathy, especially the way back in the day in first edition, they told you how to figure this out. I guess before, you know, everybody had a calculator at hand all the time. You know, they had this kind of convoluted seeming to not very mathy people way of figuring out what that half share would be and what everybody else gets. That I think a lot of players or GMs, if they saw that today, would be like, you know, I think I'm going to find something else to do with my time other than play this game. But back in the day, we were okay with that, I guess. I guess to be a DM back in the day, you had to have some basic math skills. So yeah, it got a little mathy because the henchmen got a half share of loot and XP. So, you know, if you had a group of, you know, maybe 4 PCs and 3 henchmen, you know, and they got X amount of XP and so much loot, then you had to figure out what the shares and the half shares were. Kind of complex. Luckily, I can avoid all that because in 5th edition, NPCs don't have levels. They're not player characters. They have totally different rules, which is nice. And, you know, if I have a henchman in the game, I would not have that be I would not make a player character for that. The henchman would be an NPC. And instead of having a player character with a level that's getting a half share of XP and leveling up accordingly, instead, I would just come up with a system where the henchman is an NPC with a challenge rating, and that challenge rating is a function of your player character's level. So as you gain levels over time, your henchman's challenge rating will go up, which means more hit dice, more hit points. So basically, effectively, the exact same thing as what happened in first edition, just a lot easier to do without any wonky math involved and without messing with XP payouts, which is nice because most of us, I think, running 5th edition these days aren't using XP anyway. So any system like this that referred to XP would be problematic. So, you know, the way I'm going to do it with CR, it's not going to matter if you're using milestone or if you're handing out XP. It's going to work the same way no matter which way you're doing it. Now, something that was interesting about henchmen, your hirelings were NPCs played by the dungeon master, just like all NPCs. However, the henchmen were this weird NPC that the dungeon master and the player shared. And the way this is presented in the dungeon master's guide, it's kind of assumed that this whole idea of having this NPC under your control as a player is going to be a new idea to the player. It's going to be an idea that they're going to take some time to get used to and comfortable with. So there's discussion about how to, you know, start out this henchman is completely over or under DM control, but gradually over time, you give the player more and more responsibility and control over this henchman as they feel comfortable with that, which I think is pretty interesting. You know, I mean, role-playing was a new thing back in the day of first edition D&D, so chances were good if you hadn't played D&D before, you hadn't played any RPG before. So maybe that was the valid assumption that they made, that players are going to be, you know, unsure about this and resistant to that, to it and things like that. But I think in this day and age, I don't think it's such a hurdle to get a player okay with having some responsibility for an NPC that's their henchman. But basically the way it worked was the player could control the henchman in combat as far as making roles for them and things like that. But the DM ultimately had the final word on what the henchman did as far as, you know, saying, oh, I don't think the henchman would do that. That's out of character. You need to do something else. So, you know, the henchman was largely under PC control, but the GM always had veto right if the PC was doing something or the player was doing something inappropriate with the henchman. Now, once a PC reached 10th level and built a stronghold, she could start attracting followers. So, you know, this is totally different from your hirelings and your henchmen. Your hirelings, you know, are people that you're paying to do a job for you. Henchman is a hireling that over time you've really built a rapport with, and now, you know, they're more invested in you and you're more invested in them. And now they become a PC class. They start gaining levels and things like that, getting treasure, stuff like that. Followers, on the other hand, are something that you gain just by becoming 10th level and having a stronghold. These are usually seen as fellow adventurers who are not as accomplished as the player character, who admire the player character and are following the player character in order to learn from a master, kind of thing. So if the PC is a fighter or a paladin or something like that, you know, this follower could be one of your squires that wants to be like you someday. Or if the PC is a thief or a bard or something like that, then the follower is someone that wants to study under a master. Or if the PC is a wizard, this is their apprentice. Once you reach 10th level, you would roll on a table that was based on your class to determine how many and what type of followers you would get. And usually you'd get, you know, a number of them. And then one of your followers was a special follower called a retainer. So maybe your 10th level, maybe you get a bunch of followers that are men at arms that are like third level or something. Well, your retainer would be one NPC follower that is higher level than the others. So maybe you have a bunch of men at arms are third level, and then you've got this retainer who's sixth level. And the way this was often worked out was the retainer was kind of the commander of your other followers. And, you know, a lot of times it wasn't so much that your followers and your retainer would adventure with you, because again, they're, you know, significantly lower level than you are. So that was a great way to get all your followers and your retainer killed. But a lot of times they would be manning the stronghold while you're gone. And so your retainer is the commanding officer. He's the man in charge while you're gone and directing your other followers and the hirelings and whatnot in protecting the stronghold. Or you could have your retainer and your followers out doing side quests and things for you. So I think all of this would work really well in Primordia and really fits the flavor of the setting really well. In my world of Primordia, adventurers are kind of the rock stars or the movie stars of the world. They're all a member of this guild. They're all very visible in that adventurers wear distinctive cloaks that not only marks them out as this person's an adventurer, but also tells you what adventuring team they're a part of. And so they're well recognized by the common folk in the city. So an adventurer walking down the street with his guild cloak on is going to be recognized as an adventurer. If he's a member of a successful team, the team will be recognized. And if they're really successful and famous, he might individually be recognized, just like, you know, you think about rock stars, you know, so a really popular rock band, you might recognize the band, and a super popular rock band, you might recognize the singer, right? Same kind of thing. Or a sports team would be another good example. Football team you're really into, you're going to recognize their jerseys. You're going to know who the various players are and recognize them by their number. Same kind of thing. So I think in a culture like that, where adventurers are looked up to by average people, it only makes sense that there would be people that would be aspiring adventurers and would want to kind of ride the coattails of these experienced adventurers and learn from the masters, and maybe, you know, a little bit of their success and fame will rub off on them. So I think the idea of having henchmen and followers and retainers completely makes sense for adventurers in Primordia. I also think that combining followers and hirelings with the ability to have strongholds will give PCs a lot of cool possibilities of what they can do with all that loot that they accumulate. You know, every once in a while, you'll see someone complaining about 5th edition in that they think that there's not enough for player characters to spend their gold on. You know, if you run a campaign, you know, into the high levels, start at level 1, run up to 15, 17, 20, your player characters end up with a lot of gold and treasure. And, you know, especially if you're running in a more standard D&D world where they can't just go buy magic items, it's like, what do they do with all this loot? You know, in previous editions, player characters would spend a lot of their money crafting magic items and things like that. And you know, we don't so much have that in fifth edition. And also, you know, first edition had strongholds and, you know, that you had to pay money for and had hirelings you had to pay. And again, these are money sinks that don't so much exist in fifth edition the way a lot of us are playing it right now. So I think that this will give PCs something to do with that money that isn't just a money sink, isn't just a way for the DM to siphon off some of that money, but is something that the players can be engaged in and can enjoy as its own little mini game, but that also ties into the game as a whole. It's relevant. It's not unrelated. And not only can the player characters spend gold on their hirelings that they have to pay wages for and their followers that they have to provide equipment and food and stuff for, but they also can use loot that they accumulate to outfit their followers. So maybe, you know, when you were third level, you found that +1 longsword and now you found a Holy Avenger. Instead of just selling that +1 longsword or letting it rust in the bag holding, you can give it to your retainer to use. Now your retainer has a magic longsword. And, you know, that can be really cool to have, you know, this man at arms that follows you around, that's your biggest fan, who's wearing your hand-me-down armor and magic items. And that can be a lot of fun. I think this also will open other possibilities as your trusted retainers and followers can be used to pursue side quests at the same time that the main characters do something else. And if every PC in the group has followers, you could even have those followers going on multiple side quests at the same time. It's also going to ensure that the player characters have people that they can hopefully trust with things like managing their stronghold when they're away, overseeing any business ventures that they're undertaking, like maybe they bought an inn that they're running, or maybe the fighter who also knows armor smithing opened a smithy. You know, these followers can be trusted people that can oversee those kinds of things while you're out adventuring. Finally, if you wanted to, you could have game sessions where the players actually play their retainers instead of their regular characters, just for a change of pace, just to do something different. So maybe your campaign's gotten in the high levels and you're all 15th level and on this epic, you know, world-shattering quest. It might be fun for one session to instead play your 6th level retainers that are off on their own quest and have combats that don't take an hour and, you know, just enjoy some lower level play for a session and accomplish something in that session that can be of benefit to your other characters in the main storyline. So it's not like you just went off and played another game for a night. You know, it can have bearing and relevance on your campaign and on your main characters. So all of these, I think, are really good reasons to bring strongholds and followers back in the game. You know, it can bring these added elements into your game and give player characters even more to do than just go out and fight monsters and steal treasure from people. You know, now they can work on their stronghold and maybe make it bigger or improve the defenses or repaint it a garish color or, you know, work on building their army or whatever they want to do. Or the wizard can train his apprentice or hire an alchemist to brew healing potions while you're out adventuring. I mean, the possibilities are practically endless. And I feel like this is one of those rare instances where you have something where everybody wins. The game master wins because you have some ways to divert some of the money and magic items that the group has accomplished into something that will ultimately benefit the players and will enrich your campaign. And the players won't feel like, oh, the GM just robbed me of all my treasure, right? Because, yeah, you could have a thief come in and steal all their gold and haha, you know, now you don't have all that gold. Or you could have, you know, one of their magic items get stolen or destroyed or something like that. But that always is going to feel at least a little bit like, oh, the GM kind of screwed us. He gave us treasure and then he took it away. Where on the other hand, if the player is paying gold to hire hirelings or to outfit their followers, it doesn't so much feel that way. Or if the player is, instead of selling their +1 sword in the City of Brass for a bunch of gold, they're instead giving it to their retainer to use, it doesn't feel like the DM is taking that sword away from them because their retainer is using it. And the retainer is really an extension of their character. It also can provide another option if a player character dies. You know, there's always options when the player character dies. There's resurrection, there's reincarnation, there's a deity or some other higher power sends them back, you know, to accomplish something, or they come back as a revenant. I mean, there's always things that you can do if a player character dies and you want to bring that character back and not lose that character from the story. But now if you have retainers, that could be a possibility. Well, if you don't want to bring the character back, or the player doesn't want to bring the character back, they could instead start playing their retainer. And sure, the retainer is going to start out being a few levels lower than the rest of the party, but they'll catch up. And, you know, that could be really fun for a player. Instead of coming up with a completely new character, let's use this retainer that we've already kind of developed quite a bit in the story, and let's have them get some spotlight now. I think that'd be a lot of fun. And also your players having a stronghold that they have together as a group can be a lot of fun, because now you have something as a GM that you can threaten. So the players can be, or the player characters can be out on their quest, and they get word that their stronghold is under siege. What do? Do they continue the quest, or and trust that their followers and retainers can handle defending the stronghold without them? Or are they going to beat feet back to the stronghold and protect all their stuff? Because chances are good all their treasure that they don't have with them right now is somewhere in the stronghold. So, you know, that's whatever the players decide, there's tension there, right? Whether they decide to, you know, our quest is really important, we need to stay on this, let's hope the followers can handle it. Well, there's tension because they're not going to know, right, what's happening. Or if they decide to abandon their quest and go deal with the stronghold that's under siege, well, now what happens with that quest they abandoned? You know, maybe they can just return to it later and everything's fine, but maybe not. Maybe there's some kind of consequences for them not completing their quest because they went to defend their stronghold. Either way, there's tension. Either way, there's lots there for a GM to play with. So I love asking for feedback on this show. And one thing I'd love to hear is if any of you listening to this played first edition and used these followers rules and stronghold rules, what did you think of them? And specifically, what did you especially like or not like about how followers and strongholds were handled in first edition? Because I think just looking at it myself, there are definitely aspects that I don't particularly care for, and I plan to handle differently in Primordia. For example, in first edition, it was assumed that each player character would have their own stronghold, and that's what the system demanded. You know, if you're the wizard in the party and you want to have followers, then you have to build your own stronghold, like your wizard tower or whatever. If you're a fighter, you have to build your stronghold. And I don't really like that. I mean, that would be fine in a group where only one of the player characters or one of the players wanted a stronghold and wanted followers, then that would be fine. That would work fine. But in a group where you have more than one player who wants a stronghold and followers, I'm not a fan of each of them having their own place. I think it's much more useful and fun dramatically and from a storytelling perspective if they have a single stronghold that they work on together. So what I'm planning to do is have the stronghold be a group or a party resource as opposed to an individual resource. And as long as your party has a stronghold, then you can attract followers. You don't need to have one yourself. And that way the party can have one stronghold, and instead of having each player character have a separate stronghold, instead each player character can have a part of that stronghold that's their domain. So maybe you're looking at a classic Mott and Bailey castle kind of deal, right? So, you know, maybe the fighter is responsible for the outer wall and keeping that up, and also, you know, all the soldiers that man the wall and defend the stronghold are the fighter's problem or the fighter's domain, while the wizard, you know, takes over one of the towers and that becomes his wizard's tower. And he's got a full laboratory in there and all that stuff. And he's got apprentices and scribes and whatnot working for him, while the cleric, she's got the temple and she's got people working for her. And so each player character has their part of the stronghold that's theirs, that they're in charge of, that's kind of, you know, their bat cave kind of thing. And, you know, obviously what you would need in a stronghold is going to depend on what kind of characters you have in your party. So, you know, if you have a druid in the party, then the stronghold should probably have some kind of grove or something on the land that the druid can use. You know, if there's a cleric, then there needs to be a temple or a shrine, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, if you're going to do something like this in your game, you know, don't feel like you have to do all this as a GM. You know, this is great stuff to put before the player characters or before the players. I always confuse those. Sorry about that. Put before the players and say, hey, look, you guys are going to have the stronghold together, but I want each of your characters to kind of have a part of the stronghold that's theirs. It's kind of their domain. So ask each player, you know, what would that be? And maybe the druid player will say, oh, I think it would be a grove outside of the castle. Or the druid player might say, I think it'd be cool if there was a cave below the castle and I have some kind of grove inside the cave or whatever. You know, let the players kind of think of what they think would be cool and then work with that. And if they're building the stronghold themselves, then they can make it whatever they want to be. If they're not, though, if, you know, they've inherited one or they've taken one over, then I would just, you know, either, you know, if you want to do it yourself as a GM, just figure this out ahead of time. So there's a part of that building or that castle or whatever that will fit each of the player characters, or, you know, have a discussion with the players ahead of time and be like, hey, you know, not to let the cat out of the bag, but, you know, this castle that you guys are assaulting, you could take over if you want. And if you want to do that, you know, what would your character like to have there as far as his area? So if there's a bard player, you know, what does the bard, like, what would you like to have in the castle for your bard? You know, and maybe the player will be like, oh, I think it'd be cool if this castle had like a meeting hall that I could use as a performance hall, and be like, done. There we go. So again, you know, if you played with these rules in first edition, I'd love to hear from you what you liked, what you didn't like about them, what worked, what didn't work, because, you know, I didn't have a lot experience with them myself. I never actually ran first edition. I played it a little bit and I never actually had a player character in first edition who had a stronghold or followers. I was in a few groups where other players did, so I kind of saw it, you know, from kind of a removed perspective. So I didn't really have much personal experience with these systems. So I'd really be interested to hear from any of you who played them, anything that you'd think didn't work well or was annoying about it that you'd like to see either just go away or be improved for 5th edition and or Primordia. I'd love to hear what you think. Have you checked out the Game Master's Journey community on Google Plus yet? The Game Master's Journey community is a great place to bounce ideas back and forth with other listener GMs. You can comment on the show episodes, share your own homebrew world, and ask questions of the many experienced GMs that are a part of our community. So I hope you'll check out our community and I hope you'll join us there. You can find a link to the Game Master's Journey community in the show notes for this episode over at starwalkerstudios.com/Game Master's Journey. All right, well, that is about it for episode 133. Hope you enjoyed the discussion today. Hope you had as much fun as I did. You know, I love the tradition and the history of D&D. I love that there is so much material to pull from. If you're homebrewing your own world, or if you're running in one of the published worlds like Forgotten Realms or Greyhawk or Dragonlance, there is so much out there to use as source material. And if you're a newer player or a newer GM and you've come into the hobby during 5th edition and maybe you don't have experience with any of the other previous editions of D&D, if you get to the point where you need more source material, you need more ideas for setting stuff or more ideas for more spells or more character abilities or anything like that, I strongly encourage you to check out some of the older supplements. I would especially recommend supplements from first and second edition days And even, you know, third edition 3.5 stuff can be useful as well. But the first and second edition stuff especially is incredibly easy to convert to fifth edition. And Wizards even put out a PDF with some guidelines on converting things from the previous editions in the fifth edition. And I'll have that linked in the show notes as well at starwalkerstudios.com. You can check that out. It's super easy to do. Third edition in some ways is as easy as first and second edition. In some ways is harder. It kind of depends what you're converting. Fourth edition, I don't know. You're on your own with fourth edition. I never played it. I never want to play it. I think pretty much anything worthwhile that you could steal from fourth edition, you could probably find it in 1 through 3 somewhere. Could be wrong about that, but I don't know, because I didn't play first edition or fourth edition and barely got through the PHB and the DMG reading those. But you can definitely convert stuff from earlier editions. Really easy to do. And again, that's talking about game mechanic stuff. If you're talking about setting stuff, like if you're running in Forgotten Realms and you want to know more about the realms, you know, most of the setting stuff, the mechanics or the addition of the game aren't going to matter. Now, what's going to matter with the realms is the fact that every time they come out with a new edition, they completely change things in the realms, and you'll have that to deal with. But, you know, some of the other settings are a little more evergreen than that. But yeah, there's so much out there, so much out there. And then there's all the novels, which, you know, aren't the best novels on the planet, but, you know, they're okay bathroom reading at least, and can give you some setting information, whether, you know, it's Dark Sun or Ravenloft or Forgotten Realms or Dragonlance. I don't know. Did they ever have novels for Eberron? Probably. I don't know though. But yeah, there's just a lot out there, even without going into other systems or other companies that are doing third-party stuff for D&D. Just staying within D&D itself and just going through the history of D&D, there's more than you could probably ever use. And I really encourage you to check that out. If you're a newer gamer and you haven't seen stuff from the early days, definitely check it out. Now, I'll tell you, especially first edition, terrible layout, terrible typesetting, you'll be shocked the first time you read a first edition book at how awful the presentation is, but the information's still good. And, you know, one thing that's cool is this weekend I was looking through the Castles supplement for second edition and, you know, coming up with stuff for Strongholds, and I had forgotten how much history there used to be in the game from the real world in first edition and second edition, where, you know, I don't know how accurate it is. I would hope it's somewhat accurate at least. But, you know, reading the Castles guide from second edition, there's quite a bit of history there about the evolution of castles and through time and how castles changed over time. And how the technology of castles improved as far as making them able to withstand assaults, until eventually we got to the point where you pretty much had to siege castles and wait for the people to starve or die of disease or whatnot, because they were almost impossible to impregnate. I'm not sure if that's how you say that. Impossible to breach, I guess, at least until gunpowder came on the scene, and then everything changed again. So, you know, that's really cool. And you know, that points to the roots of D&D and wargaming, and, you know, wargaming before D&D was historical. And so, you know, a lot of these guys like Gygax and Arneson were in the wargaming and were in the history. And so they would pull in that knowledge and that love of history as much as they could. And we lost that. I think it was pretty much gone in third edition, and definitely now in fifth edition. I mean, other than some references to real world pantheons in the back of the player's handbook, I think, you know, they have the Norse and the Greek pantheon and whatnot. Other than that, there's really not any reference to anything historical. These days it's full fantasy and isn't trying to align with historical places or periods, which I think overall that's good. I think it's better that we have true fantasy worlds and we're not trying to recreate someone's idea of a place or time in history, because those ideas are usually going to be false and biased anyway. But at the same time, it's kind of a shame, because it, you know, back in the day in D&D, it was a way for people that maybe don't have any other exposure to history to get some exposure to history and realize, hey, you know, there's actually some cool things about history. Maybe I want to go learn more about it. And we've definitely lost some of that. But luckily, you can still find these things, you can still read them, and you can still enjoy them even today. So that's going to wrap it up for me for episode 133. I hope that you have a chance to play your favorite RPG this week. I'll be back soon with another episode of Game Master's Journey. Until then, game on.
This has been a Starwalker Studios production, your source for quality gaming and hobby podcasts.
This episode's music, courtesy of Cloudwalker, Transboy, Renfield, Stanko, and Ish. See the show notes for more details at starwalkerstudios.com/gamemastersjourney.